So how's everybody doing?
Awesome.
Wonderful. Good. Again, I don't know how many of people don't know me. My name is Roy Heller. I am a professor of Old Testament down at SMU. I and my family, this is my home parish. I and my family have been coming here for 6 or 7 years now. And this is a class where we're sort of just slowly going through the Old Testament. In fact, all the Bible, although I doubt very seriously we'll get to the New Testament before I die, but we'll see. Old Testament's big. Those of you who've been coming, this is now, I guess, starting our almost second year now? Maybe 2.5 years? We're starting a couple of things new. Well, one thing new, and then I'm starting something new. They're recorded, and they're going to be on the website. So, you never have to show up again. I have to show up, but y'all don't have to show up. You can just stay in the privacy of your own boudoir and listen to this class all you want to. Second thing is that if you notice at the top of the handout, if the handouts have been handed out, I actually have my email address at the top of there. And what I would like to do, if you would like, you can email me and I'll put the names on a distribution list. Because what often happens, what I've noticed for the past 2.5 years, is that we get to the end of the class, and either people come up and say, what about X, Y, and Z? And I think, ooh, that's a really good question. And so we talk about it a little bit, but you all miss out on that. Another thing is that I wake up on Monday morning and I'm in the shower and I'm washing my head and it's like, oh, that's really interesting. But next Sunday, we've got to move on to something else. And so if you want to, you can email me and I'll put your name on. Just remind me what you're emailing me for. Don't just send me a blank email. It's like, okay, delete. But yeah, remind me what you're emailing me for and I'll put those all on the distribution list. Sound good?
Yes.
Cool. Awesome. Guys, we'll get started. So, the Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Blessed Lord, who has caused all scriptures to be written for our instruction, teach us so to hear them, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life that you have given to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom with you and the Holy Spirit be all honor and glory, world without end.
Amen. Amen.
Wonderful. Just some preparatory, since we're starting this whole thing again for another year, just one main preparatory thing, and that is that it strikes me that perhaps the way that we normally use scripture in the church might be a bit misleading. Surprise, surprise, that the church would mislead you on something. And that is the way in which we normally encounter scriptures in church is through the service, through the lections. The lector stands up and reads a little section, right? And the reason why that's a little disingenuous, it seems to me, is that the Bible was not written in such a way that it was broken up into discrete units, each of them having a complete thought that someone can sort of give you the moral of. Make sense? The Bible was written for a lot of different reasons. And so there's a group of people called the Lectionary Committee that go through the Bible and try desperately, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, to divide up so that there can be a reading that could last maybe 2 to 3 minutes that would make sense in and of itself, so that some fancy-schmancy person can stand up afterwards and talk about it for hopefully not longer than 15 minutes. Makes sense? But that's not the reason why the Bible is written. And so if you're coming here, I can tell you, and again, if you've been coming for the last 2 years or so, you know this is true, is that sometimes we'll come to the end of a passage, and I won't have a nice little bow tie on the end to tie everything together. And so what this means is you need to go out and be good people, or something like that, right? And my example is, again, if my opinion, if the Bible were ever opened again, so we could add books to it, right? You know what I'm talking about? My choice would be A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. No, I really would. Oh my God, what a great story. So here's a passage from A Christmas Carol. Ready? How many people know A Christmas Carol? I mean, not necessarily read it, but you know the story, right? Cool, here we go. A reading from A Christmas Carol. She clapped her hands and laughed and tried to touch his head, but being too little, laughed again and stood on tiptoe to embrace him. Then she began to drag him in her childish eagerness towards the door. He, nothing loath to go, accompanied her. The word of Charles. Cool. So there's a passage from A Christmas Carol, and we come to the end of it, and it's like, so what's the lesson we're supposed to take from that? Nothing, right? Because it's just a paragraph in a larger story of a chapter. And in fact, that chapter is in a larger story of the entire novella. Make sense? And so sometimes we'll come to the end of it, and there's not going to be a cute little takeaway, right? The way I sort of think about this is that this is kind of like a weekly meeting where we get together for lunch. Sometimes we may have a four-course dinner complete with salad and fish course, right? Sometimes we'll have chicken salad, right? Just because I don't tie things up at the end, keep coming back, right? Because it's the accumulation over, well, actually, it's accumulation over, I was going to say over weeks, perhaps over years, perhaps over a lifetime of encountering these texts that actually find their meaning. Make sense? Okay, cool. That's the only preparatory thing I have. For the past two and a half years, we've been dealing with Genesis. And that's it. Sort of Genesis. And now, we get to do something new. Finally, Exodus, which is the continuation of the same story. If you remember, at the end of Genesis, Jacob, remember Joseph? Those of you who remember, we had this story of Joseph and how he went up and down in success. And at the very end of Genesis, Jacob and his sons come down to meet Joseph in Egypt, and that's where they're living, and they're pretty successful, and then Jacob dies. And then Joseph, at the very end, in the last few verses of Genesis, Joseph finally dies. Sound good? Cool. If you don't remember that, that's fine, because we're going to pick it up a little bit before that, at the beginning of Exodus, and review. So it's like the Cliff Notes version of Genesis here, at the very beginning. Okay, here we go. Any questions, concerns, comments, prayer requests, or donations before we begin? I know it's stewardship month. Okay, cool. Excellent. So let's see what we have here. These are the names. We can stop right there. If you were to read this book in Hebrew, in fact, the name of this book in Hebrew, and again, just sort of starting off on a level playing field, the Bible wasn't written in English. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, New Testament was written in Greek. It wasn't written in English. There's a great scene in My Fair Lady. You know My Fair Lady? Henry Higgins, Eliza. At the very beginning, she's there and she's selling her flowers, feed the birds and stuff. Ow, governor, blah, 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 blah. And Rex Harrison is so great. He says, you are an affront to the language of Shakespeare, Chaucer, and the Bible. In fact, the Bible wasn't written in English. It was written in Hebrew. If you read this book in Hebrew, anybody read Hebrew? A little bit, yeah. Good. Then you just have to take my word for anything I say, which I like. If you were to read this book in Hebrew, in fact, the name of this book in Hebrew is not Exodus. The name of this book in Hebrew is Shemot. Say Shemot.
Shemot.
Say Shemot.
Shemot.
Say Shemot.
Shemot.
Beautiful. Excellent. And what Shemot means is names.
That's the name of it. And again, most of the books in the Torah, that is the first five books, most of the books in the Torah are taken out of the first near the beginning of the book. So one of the first words of the book. And so the name of this book is Names, Shemot.
Which is kind of interesting, actually, when you think about it, especially in these first few weeks that we're reading. Just pay attention to who gets named and who doesn't. You have to keep this in mind because it's not just today. It's going to be over the next month or so. But just pay attention to who's named and who's not named. Okay? It's just something to pay attention to, which is kind of interesting. Here we go. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. And here we go. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Just to review, Jacob has two wives, which is never a good thing in the Bible. It really isn't. I don't know. Everybody says, oh, polygamy. It never worked out. He had two wives, and he also had two concubines, the sort of the servants of the wives that take on sort of familial relationships with him. So he has two wives and two concubines, Leah, Rachel, and the two concubines are Bilhah and Zilpah. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah are all children of Leah. Cool. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun are sons of Bilhah, the concubine. Benjamin is the son of Rachel. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher are the sons of Zilpah. Don't try this at home. I'm a professional. Right? Cool. Awesome. So there's his 11 children right there. The total number of people born to Jacob was 70. That is all of his sons, all of his grandsons, all of his granddaughters, all of his wife, or daughters-in-law, all of that stuff. Joseph was already in Egypt, and so that makes the 12. Maybe you've heard of the 12 tribes of Egypt. Have you? Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Right, so, there's the 12. So there's the 12. Joseph's already in Egypt. Cool. Joseph died, which happens at the very end of Genesis, and all his brothers and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied. They grew exceedingly strong, so that the land, that is the land of Egypt, was filled with them. That little phrase there, one of the things I'm not going to do for you at the end of every lesson, sometimes it will happen, just fortuitously, just fortunately. One of the things I'm not going to do for you is sort of tie things up at the end and give you a takeaway lesson about how you need to love Jesus more or something like that. If you want that, you can go to other denominations. We don't do that in the Episcopal Church. I'm not going to necessarily give you a takeaway. But one of the things I will do for you throughout this class is sort of make connections for you, especially those of you who've been here for the past 2 years, sort of make connections back, and those of you who are somewhat familiar with the Bible as a whole, sort of make connections elsewhere. Sound good? That's kind of what I sort of see my role as. When I read something like, the Israelites were fruitful and prolific, they multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them, that rings a bell in my head, and you can see the little footnote there. It rings a bell in my head, and that is when we first started this 2 years ago, and I've got a good memory for the Bible, not with anything else, but with the Bible, I've got a pretty good memory. When we started this two and a half years ago, the very first chapter in the Bible, Genesis 1, God creates everything. Remember 7 days and all this kind of stuff? He creates everything, and the very first command that he gives to humanity, human beings, the very first command that God gives to human beings is be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. Which is kind of interesting because here at the beginning, very beginning of the very next book, we have that same sort of pattern echo. So it seems as though, compared with a lot of other stuff that happened, they actually obey this command. Understandably so. Because it's one of the few commands that's actually fun to fulfill. They're fruitful and they're prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. You might as well call this the land of Israel, right? There's so many that they're just everywhere in Egypt. So far, so good? Doing good? Okay, cool. Now, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So we know Jacob, we know his sons, we know Joseph, a new king arose over Egypt whose name was, we have no idea. We have absolutely no idea. You take a look at all the scholarship, we have absolutely no idea who this pharaoh is or who's supposed to be. There's no name given to this pharaoh. Pharaoh isn't a name. Pharaoh is just a title like king. We have absolutely no idea, which is kind of interesting, right? The most powerful man in the whole world, we have absolutely no idea who it is. But we know about Gad and Asher, right? A new king arose over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. And we're going to keep our eye on this pharaoh, this king of Egypt, because he's going to have certain characteristics. He said to his people, look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we are. And I can tell you, that's not just a normal thing. He's scared. This troubles him. Okay, and you'll find out. I'm not telling you anything. I don't know. I don't go to the Vatican secret archives and look things up and know what this person. But actually, you can tell this in the next few sentences. I'm just giving you that. So it's troubling to him that they're more numerous and they're more powerful. So far, so good. Okay. In other words, he doesn't want them to become more numerous and he doesn't want them to become more powerful. So far, so good. Again, I try to. Come on. Let's deal shrewdly with them, or they'll increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. In stories, as a whole, anybody a creative writer? You write like stories, not necessarily poetry, but stories. Anybody creative writer? You like to write stories? Yeah. It's an interesting, for me at least, and again, I've done this a bit in my past, and I just know about other authors, spend a great deal of time thinking about how to start their story. We always think the climax is the most important part of the story. In fact, the thing that authors spend a lot of time is, what's the very first thing I'm going to tell, right? That very first line, right? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That's all you need. You can just stop right there. There's the whole story right there. And in a sense, it really is, because the whole story has to do with the late 17th century or the late 1700s, where, you know, it was the best of times. I mean, freedom, liberty, 1776, you know, right? It was also the worst of times. French Revolution, guillotine, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake, right? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And against that backdrop, that's where everything else. But in a sense, the whole book is just an illustration of that very first sentence, right? Call me Ishmael. What's the main character's name? We have absolutely no idea. What he says to you, though, is call me Ishmael. And who's Ishmael? Again, those of you who've been with me, right? He's the son of Abraham through the slave Hagar that gets cast out, that has to wander, that doesn't have a home. Call me Ishmael. Boom. Mic drop, right? That's all you need right there. That's the whole book, right, in a sense. Right here, at the very beginning of Exodus, we're told important things about this pharaoh. He's scared because the people are numerous and strong. And there's one thing that he absolutely does not want. He doesn't want these people to leave. Which is kind of ironic, right? Because if you're scared of them, why don't you kick them out and then build a wall? why are you laughing? He doesn't want them to leave, but he's kind of scared of them, right? And so the way in which he's going to deal with this situation is that he's going to be smart, right? Let's deal shrewdly with them, right? So the one thing that I know a few things about this pharaoh. He's scared. He doesn't want the people to leave. Spoiler alert, the name of the book is Exodus. What do you think happens? Right? He's scared that they're numerous and strong. He doesn't want them to leave. And the way he's going to solve that problem is that he's going to be really, really smart. Okay. So he thinks of himself as very smart. He's going to be really, really smart. And so, in order to solve that situation, this is what he does, right? Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses for Pharaoh. So the way in which he's going to deal with their strength and their numbers, that they're going to keep them there, is that in a sense he enslaves them, right? He puts taskmasters over them. And he oppresses them. This is a word that's going to appear actually a lot. Actually, it occurred in
Genesis quite a few times, and I brought it up a few times when it did occur. But this is going to be a really big word, the word oppress. Anna. Yeah, it means oppress. Well, it doesn't really mean oppress. It does mean oppress. But
it means it's tied up with the idea. The way I like to think about Anna, and the way it occurred, for those of you who've been with me, where it occurs in Genesis, particularly with the relationship between Sarah and Hagar. Whenever she gets pregnant and she looks on Sarah, ooh, I'm pregnant, you're not, right? Sarah's reaction to that is to oppress her. And we talked about this before. And when I think about the word oppress, this is sort of what I think about. You take somebody, take a human being, a person, right? You strip them to the waist. You stand them so that they're standing like this. I'm standing here, so they're facing that way. And I take a 2x4 and I whack them as hard as I can, right about there. And you know that sound that a human being will make when that happens to them?
No.
Anna. So it's not just oppressing them by, certain blue laws so they can't buy alcohol on Sundays or something like that. Right? It's not oppressing like that. It's like abuse. Physical abuse of these people. This is going to be important. This is going to be an important word all the way through. So Pharaoh, because he's scared, because he doesn't want the people to leave, the way in which he deals with that is that he's very smart. And this is the way he deals with them. He's going to set them into slavery and oppress them. Right? Torture them. That's a good word. Torture them. With forced labor. And their point here, what they do for him, is that they build supply cities, Pithom and Ramses for Pharaoh. I know the name of two supply cities in Egypt, but I have absolutely no idea who this king is. It's kind of interesting names, right? Pithom and Ramses. Supply cities. What do you do with supply cities? I'm tired of talking. What do you do with what are supply cities for?
Fill them up.
Fill them up with?
Supplies.
Yeah, supplies or
food,
yeah. So you put grain there and all of this kind of stuff. So they're because obviously Egypt is going to, he's expecting lots of stuff, lots of produce, lots of grain, lots of stuff. That's going to be completely undercut. Just be aware. There's going to be these things called plagues. Spoiler alert! Plagues. It's going to be completely undercut. But it's kind of important right now. So they're building these supply cities for Pharaoh, Pithom and Ramses. Here's, again, this occurs right in the center of this first chapter. The more that they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. Get this, because it's really important. The more they're oppressed, the more they multiply and spread. The more they're oppressed, the more they multiply. All right, now I'll ask you, ignore the story. You're Pharaoh. You're scared of these people. You don't want them to leave. And so what you think is going to help is that you'll oppress them. However, after doing that, the result of that is, in fact, they become even stronger and even more numerous. So let me ask you a question. What do you do? You stop oppressing them! Right? You start making margarita machines for them, setting up hammocks, right? Right? And then they get fat and lazy, and then they just become like cattle, right? Or something like, I don't know. But you stop oppressing them. The more they're oppressed, the more they multiply, the stronger they get. Pharaoh, however, is really, really smart. And so what he's going to do is that he's going to oppress them even more. And the result is going to be? We're going to become stronger and stronger and stronger. Pharaoh thinks he's very smart. He's not smart. And I can tell you this is going to continue practically through the entire, up until, where are we now? We're in October. This is going to continue all the way to December. He thinks he's really smart. He thinks he knows how to solve problems. He's going to set something in motion. It's not going to work. And so he's going to do it even more. This is what we call stubborn. And it never occurs with politicians. Never. Except for Pharaoh. In the ancient world, as including all societies, almost every society, at least the societies that I know about and I've read about, almost all societies take parts of the human body and associate them with certain mental or emotional aspects of being a human being. I'll give you an example. In February, in the middle of the month, we tell people that we love them, right? And so one of the ways that we do that is that we cut out hearts and give them to each other. Kind of gruesome, actually. What is this culture? I do not understand. Why do you give hearts? Right? What are you, vampires? I don't know. Again, but in this culture, the heart is representative of love, right? And again, it's so natural for us that we don't even think about it. So far, so good. If somebody is really, really smart, we say that he's an egghead or something like this, because there's something about the head in this culture, quite apart from brain and synapses and all of this stuff that we've learned in the past, 150 years. But quite apart from that, even before people knew, even when people thought that this thing was just sort of had a bunch of gray stuff in it to keep it from collapsing, right? Even before that, this was somehow associated with rationality and reason and things like this. Right, so in our culture, the head is associated with reason. So far, so good. I think fear for us is kind of a belly type of thing. You know, your bowels turn to water or something like this, right? Your stomach is in cramps. Right, or something like this, right? In ancient Israel, in the ancient world as a whole, in this first millennium BC, in fact, the thing that you love with isn't your heart. The thing that you love with is your guts. This is what you love with. So I guess you would cut out intestines and send them to each other on February, I guess. I don't know. The head is representative of hardly anything at all. They sort of thought of the heart or the head as sort of just this thing that has eyes that can turn, and it doesn't really do anything psychologically or emotionally for us. The thing that we think with in the ancient world, the thing that we think with is the heart. It's the heart that's the seat, not of love, not of emotion. The heart is the seat of rationality, of reason. So we think with the heart. This is really, really important, because what we're going to see over and over and over is that Pharaoh is going to have a hard heart. He's going to be a hard-hearted man. In our culture, what it means to be hard-hearted is that you don't love. You're callous, you're cruel, you're hard-hearted. In the ancient world, hard-hearted didn't mean that you were mean. He is mean. It's not that he's callous. He is callous. But when we say that Pharaoh is hard-hearted and he's going to be hard-hearted for a long time, when we say that he's hard-hearted, it's not that he's mean. It's that he's hard-headed. He gets an idea in his head and he can't let it go. He's stubborn. Even when every evidence in the world says that he's wrong, he's stubborn. He's not going to change. And in fact, his stubbornness is going to lead him to do whatever it is that he's doing even more. So far, so good? Okay, cool. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. They weren't just scared of them now, they dread them, right? Not only that, but the Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites. And the more ruthless they become, the more the Israelites get stronger and they spread even more. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites, and they made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. Just notice how the narrator is sort of beating us over the head that how horrible this is. But we already know the secret, and that is that the more they're oppressed, the more they grow. The more they're ruthlessly dealt with, the stronger they get. Which is exactly the opposite of what they want. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was Puah. So I know the names of two Hebrew midwives, but I have absolutely no idea who this Pharaoh is. Just notice the names, the way the names are being used. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was Puah, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women, and you see them on the birth stool, right? They're about ready to give birth. If it's a boy, kill him. And if it's a girl, she shall live. Right? Because what he's afraid of is people multiplying. He doesn't want these Israelites to multiply. Make sense? Cool. Let's go back, shall we, to eighth grade health. I'm going to set up two scenarios. You ready? Suppose I have a situation where I have one man and a dozen women. How many babies can I conceivably, notice what I did there, have in a year?
12.
12. Suppose I have a situation where I have one woman and a dozen men. How many babies can I conceivably have in a year?
One.
If I want to limit eighth grade health, if I want to limit a population, and I'm going to do that through murder, who am I going to kill? Exactly. The women. You kill the women, they're the ones that are giving birth. So far, so good. Not the ones that are... Right? So far, so good. Everybody understand the point that he's killing the wrong people? Just to put the cookies on the bottom shelf, right? He's killing the wrong people. Second thing is that what are these Israelites doing for Pharaoh? It just says it. They're working hard, and they're building store cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. So far, so good? Ancient Israel, I don't know if you know this, ancient Israel did not have the Equal Rights Amendment. It was not very equanimous between men and women. In fact, the people that are out there building these store cities, these people that are doing the hard labor in the fields, are most probably
men.
Simultaneously, he's so brilliant. Simultaneously, he is not solving at all the overpopulation problem and undercutting his workforce. Brilliant. Let's deal shrewdly with him. He's an idiot, right? And he's an idiot not because he doesn't know eighth grade health, which is idiot enough, but he's primarily an idiot because he's hard-headed. He gets an idea in his head, and he will not let it go, which we'll see in a second. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, she should live. But the midwives feared God, and they didn't do as the king of Egypt commanded them. They let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, sup with that, right? Why have you done that? Why have you allowed the boys to live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, well, because the Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. They're vigorous. Not like your lazy girls. Egyptian women. Sitting around eating Doritos, right? No! These Hebrew women are vigorous. They give birth, pop them out like popcorn. And they give birth before the midwife even comes to them. In fact, we're out of a job, right? We don't even have anything to do, right? Well, what are you going to do? And so God dealt well with the midwives because they're actually saving the Hebrew boys. And the people multiplied, and they become very strong, not just strong, but very strong now. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them, in the NRSV, the version that we read in church, the version that most mainline denomination, Christian denominations use, is what's called the New Revised Standard Version. You can see it there at the top, New Revised Standard Version. It was translated, or it was finally the edition, the latest edition was in 1996, early 90s. And the NRSV, New Revised Standard Version, NRSV translation here says, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. There's a perfectly good word for family in Hebrew, mishpacha, that I'm not going to write up because it's not used here. It's not the word families, in fact. The word that's used here is households, or rather houses. He gave them houses. And I always think that this is a rather interesting point here at the end of this first story, is that we're dealing with the book of Exodus as a whole, and we're not going to get done with it. We're only going to get halfway done with it this fall. I'll try to move us along in the spring to get done with it in the spring, but this year, by May, hopefully we'll get done with the book of Exodus. I can tell you, in the book of Exodus, it's kind of interesting, is that here at the very beginning, God provides a house, or houses, for these midwives. By the end of the book, Israel is going to provide a house for God, the tabernacle. And so, this is a great word because it's going to get used over and over and over. I'm going to write it sideways because I'm running an inclusio. Say inclusio.
Inclusio.
Say inclusio.
Inclusio.
Beautiful. And inclusio is like a bookend. And that is whatever appears at the beginning of a story happens at the end of the story. This happens in a version of Red Riding Hood, right? Don't go off the path or you'll, you know, mess up, the mother says. And at the very end of the story, Red Riding Hood says, oh, I'm always going to do what my mother says. Right? So that's an inclusio. So we sort of end the story where we begin the story. The book of Exodus as a whole is set up as a huge inclusio where we have God giving people a house at the beginning, and we have people giving God a house at the end. So it's, again, it's really beautiful. At the very, very end, then Pharaoh commanded all his people. Who's he commanding? Again, I'm not trying to fool you.
The Egyptians.
Yeah, he's trying, all his people, the Egyptians, right? He's not commanding Hebrew midwives. He's not commanding Israelites, right? He's commanding his people, his own people. And this is what he says, that every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live. You see, here's the hard-headedness, right? So he's sticking with it, even though it doesn't make any sense. Just notice the little footnote, because this is kind of important. And that is, you see the words to the Hebrews I have in brackets. I mean, so all of this stuff like italicizing, paragraphing, footnotes, other types of things besides normal punctuation is stuff I put into the text. You can see to the Hebrews is in brackets. And if you go down, when you read this story in Hebrew, in the Hebrew text, to the Hebrews isn't there. It's added in later translations, and I can understand why they would want to add it. Because if you don't add it, it doesn't make any sense. Because this is what happens at the end of this scene. Pharaoh commanded his own people. He commands the Egyptians. Every boy that is born, you throw into the Nile. Let every girl live. And then somebody in the back raises their, Hermione, right, raises their hand in the back of the class and says, oh, but that doesn't make any sense. Obviously, it has to only refer to the Hebrews, right? It's not going to refer to the Egyptians, because that wouldn't make any sense. And my response is, yeah, just like everything else Pharaoh has done up to this point has made perfect sense, right? No. Consistently, point after point after point after point, he's irrational. He's stubborn. He gets the idea that if he killed baby boys, it's going to take care of the situation. Just killing Hebrews isn't taking care of the situation. So, We're going to kill them all. Doesn't make any sense. Of course not. He's an idiot. One more thing. Just notice, unlike with the midwives, here he actually tells his own people how to kill the baby boys. And how do you kill the baby boys? You throw them in the Nile. The Nile, the source of life, the source of irrigation, the source of the crops that he's planning on getting to put into the storehouses, the source of life, itself becomes a source of death. Right here, in the story, and that's done by Pharaoh. I can tell you that the Nile is going to show up later in our stories. And it's going to be a source of death. But I can guarantee you that the person that set that in motion is Pharaoh. Thank you.